November 23rd, 2020, in Los Angeles. This is Los Angeles Podcast. I'm Hayes Davenport. I'm here with Alyssa Walker and Scott Frazier. Hello?
Hello.
Isn't it LA Podcast? It's not Los Angeles Podcast.
We got to decide. At some point, we have to decide.
Somebody asked me recently if the was capitalized, and I said, I don't think there is a "the," but we haven't decided.
For now, there is a "the" until another show shows up and names it. It names itself LA Podcast, not knowing that we exist. We are the LA Podcast.
Ruth's LA Pod.
We've got a big episode today. We have a extended interview with return guests Doug Smith and Ben Oreskes, reporters from the LA Times who are on the homelessness beat and wrote an article this week about bridge housing in Los Angeles and its successes and failures and a lot of the political and policy implications. And we just talk about a lot of stuff related to homelessness. So that's in a second. Right now, we want to talk about the novel coronavirus. It's Thanksgiving week. None of us are traveling, right, for Thanksgiving. Like, I'm just hanging out.
I mean, I'm considering it, but I first just want to write, like, an op-ed, just, like, outlining my plans, and then...
That's a good way to feel out.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to, like, map out, like, who I know and who I encounter, like, in my daily... activities.
And if the number is big enough, you'll go anyway.
I'm on vacation, which for me during COVID means instead of doing my daily routine of moving from the bed to the couch, I might just stay in bed for the next week. I'm not going anywhere. I will be planted.
I mean, the fact that we are entering a very dangerous week for people getting together with the largest spike in COVID cases that we have seen in LA County by a pretty huge margin. We broke 5,000 cases in a day this week. Like every day has been between 4,000 and 5,000. Huge, huge increases in case numbers. And now we are seeing deaths and hospitalizations start to really spike as well. We have almost 1,400 people currently in the hospital with COVID. That's up from 600, 700 a few weeks ago. And we are very quickly reaching another peak in terms of current hospitalizations. We got as high as 2,000 in mid-July, but we are now, those numbers are rising they jumped by 93 today. So by the end of the week, we could be back at 2,000 people in the hospital. And you saw, Scott, the mayor say earlier in the summer that we had a capacity of 2,300 hospital beds for COVID. Is that right?
Yeah, so I mean, since the departure of the U.S. hospital ship, the Mercy, which had been located at the Port of L.A. and ultimately was never needed during the spring, there have been...
Except some people did get COVID on it.
Right, it didn't really right? work. Yeah. Some people actually on it.
I thought they weren't even using it for people who were COVID positive. But anyway, so the hospital ship departed. Other surge centers, so-called, were closed down. And yeah, since that time, there have been about, I think it's between 2,300 and 2,400 hospital beds available in LA County. So that is, roughly speaking, I don't believe there's been any major changes since then. That is the cap that we're looking at right now. A change like 93 people being checked in a day is very, very concerning, especially as we expect that the uptick in, the main uptick in hospitalizations is still to come. Everyone is just sort of looking with considerable anxiety at the post-holiday period.
And this is not unique to Los Angeles.
Not at all.
And if anything, we're better off than many parts of the country that are seeing even more significant increases. But it's very, very bad. And in terms of rising cases, it's the worst that we have seen. It's a nightmare. So, Alyssa, what are we doing?
Not enough, I would argue. So we're recording this on Saturday night. Getting very close to the... Actually, right right now.
We are 3 minutes
we
from
are
having to
in the
stop
window.
The podcast. For the,
yeah,
the,
I mean,
the,
does this count as a gathering? It's podcast. Three of us in a Zoom room. But the governor, Gavin Newsom, got up on his pedestal. I don't want to make any French Laundry jokes, but it's so hard not
pedestal.
To. And declared a curfew for a 3-week curfew. It ends on December 21st, which again, like, why not just go all the way through Christmas? Really confusing. Like, you know, we're going to be home anyway.
But sir, it's Christmas. I'd like to stay up and...
It's kind of like Ben Stiller in the movie Heavyweights.
Yes. Wow. Anderson. Oh my gosh. That's an amazing reference. So he declared or imposed whatever, a curfew. Did not call it a curfew. I just want to give him a little shout out because I wrote this story where I looked at like all the different measures being implemented across the country. Many people are calling these curfews and saying that you have to be home or businesses have to close or you can't gather, you can't be with people in public after 10 p.m. Ours is not actually that. Ours is technically a stay-at-home, a limited stay-at-home order. So they were very smart in not saying the word curfew because I feel like as soon as they would say curfew, they would be sued by the ACLU within a minute because of everything that happened and went down here in the summer where... They were just like coming up with curfews like every day just for no reason. And
sure.
They were saying, you actually can't do that. It's very, you're basically criminalizing people.
This is now substantially broader. This is in every purple tier county.
Yes,
in
40
the
counties.
State, as
40 counties
to
the, in the state. 95% of the population, right? So most people are under this. But it's not necessarily like a curfew in a way that could be enforced like a curfew. It's just going back to the stay-at-home order, which I don't think anybody ever really got in trouble for going against the stay-at-home order.
Yeah. And you have law enforcement, you have like county, like the LA Sheriff's Department is saying, we're not going to
enforce
this.
Yeah, they all
this.
Said, many counties said, we're not actually going to enforce this or do anything. So I think I do appreciate the wording being specific and saying that it's similar to what we already have been through. However, making it a 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew really does nothing, especially when you look at what we're going through this particular week coming up. We are allowed to have 15-person gatherings with 3 households anywhere in the state. Mm-hmm. There is, they say they encourage not to travel, but there's no restrictions on traveling. Actually, you could go get on a plane tomorrow and fly to San Francisco and go to a gathering with other people in households in San Francisco. You could go shopping on Black Friday and stand in line next to a bunch of workers who are not protected in any way and will probably have to be there under the conditions of their job.
Wasn't that a story in, I don't know if it was the LA Times or not. Wasn't there a story this week that was like, are you planning on going to Black Friday? Like, get there early. Like,
yeah. Oh, no. There were so many stories. Like, there were stories about how to fly even though you're not supposed to or how you're supposed to travel, quote unquote, responsibly or shop, quote unquote, responsibly. And there, it doesn't reflect any of the things we were actually being told or actually know about what's going on because there's no guidance whatsoever from really anyone. Even the CDC didn't say you couldn't travel until less than a week before Thanksgiving. Our own assembly member, Wendy Carrillo, my assembly member who has been on a junket this week. Do you call it a junket when it's part of a congressional? Do you call it a junket when it's elected officials? But Wendy Carrillo has been in Hawaii this week, even when we were told not to travel, non-essential travel. Out of the state of California and posted a tweet that used her location and proved that she was in Hawaii. A handful of many people who are elected officials in California who are there and people need to be taking more responsibility for their travel right now. It's something that we're not really thinking about.
You know, it's interesting. It's hard to tell what really is driving this right now on a personal level? What is driving this enormous uptick in not just Los Angeles, like Hayes was saying, but across the country? A week ago, there were reports on Twitter that the state of Oklahoma had reached hospital bed capacity over the course of the last week. There was a nurse in South Dakota who attracted national attention when she was talking about the fact that she was unable to convince people who had COVID that it was a serious illness, even as it was killing them. The growth in cases, particularly in the middle of the country, has been devastating. And yet, what we see, I mean, so you mentioned it in passing. I think it is important. What you see among the people who should know better, the people who are most well-disposed to understand the seriousness of the threat, be they state legislators, be they Governor Gavin Newsom, be they, you know, reporters for the New York Times, and we get into that in a second, but all of these people who have the means to protect themselves and the wherewithal to, and the willingness to understand the seriousness of the threat that this pandemic poses, it seems like everybody's just given up completely. And like the most meager protect yourself and your family elements of this have sort of fallen by the wayside. And that's how you get these newspaper stories that are like, here's how to travel to see your family during COVID, even though you know that you shouldn't. That was like basically the gist of a headline that the LA Times ran. It's like, you're not going to be safe, and so we're going to help you be unsafe.
They had multiple headlines. They had how to fly, how to drive, and like other ways to get there if you, quote, have to, which right. Nobody really does. But I also want to point out, this same week, three LA Times reporters lost grandparents to COVID. Brittany yeah. Mejia, Haley Branson Potts, and Emily Albert Reyes all lost grandparents, family members, which is more likely to happen, presumably, as a result of families yeah. convening on Thanksgiving. And still, I would say that wasn't as irresponsible as what we saw from the New York Times or one specific columnist this week.
I'm sure, well, who knows what will appear in print tomorrow, because the column was changed by three paragraphs. You know, there was this outrage in the morning, and then by the afternoon, the story had changed so significantly that I don't even know what's going to appear in print tomorrow and what most grandparents that will read the paper on that Sunday morning will pick up and call their children and be like, why aren't you coming to see me? This New York Times columnist is going to do it. So why aren't you going to come visit me? It's going to create all sorts of like, you know, generational strife. But Farhad Manjoo, who is NY Times opinion columnist, is it opinion within the opinion?
Mm-hmm.
So many opinions to talk about in these podcasts, but it's normally, I think, a really great columnist on many issues and someone that I look up to a lot on many as a writer and as a person who really gets into it on a lot of issues that I think are important. But I think Scott actually put it the most well in something that he shared today, which is just like, this is the ultimate like pinnacle of privilege to use all the resources and science around you to go through this decision and yet at the end decide that you are the exception to this situation and that you should be able to do whatever you do. And if you haven't read the op-ed, it basically is this gorgeously illustrated story that shows how big your bubble actually is. And I will take one exception to his idea of bubble, because we have pods and we have bubbles or whatever you want to call it. But if you actually had a pod, you would actually limit your behavior and your interactions to a very small number. And it turns out that his was actually quite large because he was sending his children to school and gymnastic classes. And those people were sending their kids to other schools and other classes. And one of the people in his pods is actually like a doctor who was working in an emergency room. So that actually doesn't really count as a pod. That's just basically living your normal life in a pandemic. But I think what we need to think about here is there's two things that I think we're kind of critical. One is we don't have any kind of guidance telling us what to do. So of course people are going to be making their own decisions, and that's it's really hard. Like it's we're all taking risks. We're all doing things that aren't probably not the right thing to do, but we don't have anyone, even the CDC, telling us what we're supposed to be doing. Even our local government here hasn't, in LA, hasn't been giving us the proper and reinforced information to tell us what to do. They've been saying a lot of things, but nothing's been very straight. But also, using your platform to say that something like that is okay. And then I think he changed kind of what he was saying and they republished it and just put it back out there. People are going to use that as a reason to say that they should be able to do whatever they want to do. And in fact, this is not the moment to do that. This is a moment to actually not only cancel Thanksgiving, but give the money that you were going to spend on Thanksgiving to like your local mutual aid groups here in Los Angeles and just say, I'm not doing Thanksgiving at all. I want someone else to have a meal. Like not even thinking about it in that way, but just saying, this is an exceptional time.
You know, this story was ill-considered on basically every level. It's so hard to even fathom what the New York Times, what the editorial board was, frankly, or what the editor of the opinion pages was thinking in allowing this to run in this format, where you have what's actually a well-executed look at, you know, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, basically. that is like looking at how many people are sort of invisible within the immediate context that you come in contact with as an individual living in an urban environment. That is, I think, poorly understood and immensely important, particularly when we talk about the spread of an epidemic, where our diseases thrive on these so-called small world networks where you are connected to people that you don't see and might never actually meet in person. Farhad Manjoo taking that as the basis for a story, which he completely eviscerates at the end by saying, I feel more confident about my personal safety because I talked to these people. They're no longer invisible to me. I've spoken to them, and now I have a personal sense of security because I think that they are being careful, which is not exactly a scientific. It really undermines the entire scientific basis to this at the end by basically just saying, this is what I want to do, and so I'm going to find a justification to do it. It's not different from the people who say COVID is not a threat or just refuse to believe the seriousness of the disease, except in the fact that it's almost worse,
it's worse.
A little bit.
It is worse.
In a way, because
it's
like you're saying, I know how big of a deal this is, but I trust that everybody else on the planet is going to carry the weight of behaving responsibly so I can not behave responsibly. I can knowingly avoid my personal responsibility and go do something that is has been compared to holding a gun to your grandmother's head by disease scientists. It's the incredibly the wrong thing to do. And the most offensive thing in my mind is the end, the very last line where he says, you know, but for family, it's worth it. The implication, of course, being exactly the polar opposite of the truth, which is that if you actually care about your family, you will risk all of their lives and your own to see them when it is unnecessary to do so.
What really concerns me is it's the, like, kind of what you were talking about, this idea of just giving up, and that people somehow think that their choices don't matter. Are we going to see that 405 lit up with those taillights as we always do on whatever day that is of this week's holiday? I mean, we already saw there was a lot of people at LAX. It's not even the biggest travel day yet. Like, there's still time to make that decision. People, I don't know, our listeners are probably not these people who are, who have put themselves in this decision, but there is actually still time to change your plans. And anyone that you can talk to about that, you should do that. You should try to have those conversations that will allow people to just change what they are going to doing, or change what they're going to do, or talk to someone who might do something differently this week.
Barbara Ferrer was saying if we behave well on Thanksgiving, then we may start to see reduced numbers in 2 weeks, which means that we're probably stuck at this shockingly high plateau for another 2 weeks. We're in like a really, really desperate situation. But the New York Times column is not a local story, obviously, but how it does connect locally, I think, is there is this pervasive attitude towards this that's hard to resist, which is to feel like they wouldn't let us do this if it were that dangerous. They would stop us. No, they would not. They are letting us do it. It is that dangerous. You are entirely on your own. And your decision to put yourself and your family in or out of danger is not being regulated in any meaningful way whatsoever by the people that have been assigned to protect you.
And Farhad lives in California, by the way. We're talking about a New York columnist, but he lives in the Bay Area. And he's in these same counties that we are in as far as the restrictiveness, which, again, like I said before, have no real rules except for go home by 10 p.m.
Yes. Yes. Here's why it could be a local story. I mean, like, he didn't say where he was going. He could be coming here. And you've seen how big his network is.
5 hours away, you could draw, like, a circle and be like, get out of here.
Right.
Turn back.
And like that's a risk alone. Like, you don't want to go outside because he and that entire network could be coming to Los Angeles.
Coming to a city near you.
Speaking of people's networks, speaking of elected officials, the unfolding saga of Rick Jacobs, senior advisor to Mayor Eric Garcetti, continues to unfold this week with a picture. Finally, we have a visual piece of evidence and like the oppo drops that have been slowly coming out about this. Rick Jacobs was first sued by a member of Mayor Garcetti's security team for sexual harassment and assault. And then journalist Yashar Ali accused him of the same, essentially, over a period of a number of years. And a couple of anonymous complaints have come forward as well, saying that Rick Jacobs was a person who consistently made people uncomfortable in public with sexual comments and groping and, like, at times verging on and into assault, and that there are a lot of claims that this is something that Mayor Garcetti knew was an ongoing issue and never did anything about. He has now cast Rick Jacobs out of his employ. Rick Jacobs was a major fundraiser for him, both and originally in his campaign and now for the Mayor's Fund, Accelerator for America, all these various nonprofit entities that Garcetti runs. Rick Jacobs is no longer in Garcetti's circle. But now this photo has come out from 2017 from the U.S. Conference of Mayors in Miami that shows Rick Jacobs with his hand over somebody's crotch, like as if he's groping them in the photo. and Garcetti's giving a double thumbs up. He is on the other side of the guy who is being pretend groped, but he said that he didn't see it. Garcetti says he didn't see it.
He's literally right next to that person. You said on the yes. other side, but he's literally standing right next to that person.
Yes. And he says the behavior is horrible. The person in the photo has not been identified. I do know the person's identity. It's someone who works closely with the city, with city government. It's someone who Rick Jacobs would definitely have been acquainted with. But this is exactly what Al Franken was shown doing and was essentially kicked out of the Senate for doing. But Garcetti continues to claim that this is something that he didn't have any knowledge of, including as this picture was being taken. He is still up for consideration for Secretary of Transportation in the Biden administration. Do we think that that is now not going to happen because of this? Which, I mean, would seem to be the intention of whoever is releasing, parceling out this information and timing it the way that they have.
It does seem to be a steady drip of new info about this. Will this result in Eric Garcetti not getting the transportation secretary job? I think at this point, yes. I do. I've switched. I don't think that he is, that Mayor Garcetti is destined to land a spot in the Biden cabinet.
Because of this photo.
Yeah, and I think that it's important to note that really context is everything here. In a vacuum, this picture comes out, and yeah, it's potentially believable that somebody made a poor behavioral decision. It's even conceivable that Mayor Garcetti doesn't see this happening as the picture is taken. It's hard to say because it's, you know, a picture is a brief moment in time. However, in the context of everything that we have heard, the numerous, I think, numbering in the dozens of sources that Yashar Ali spoke to about this story, about the mayor's knowledge of Rick Jacobs' behavior and his discussions about the same. When you pair those with this particular photo, I feel like the story changes pretty dramatically. You look at this and it is hard to imagine Garcetti successfully navigating a confirmation hearing, again, controlled by the Republicans, the head of whom is married to the outgoing Secretary of Transportation and is not necessarily above just feeding somebody to the sharks for the sheer fun of it.
You're saying that Garcetti might find out that there actually are red states and blue states. And that actually does have practical implications.
Oh my God, yeah.
Sometimes.
Wow.
It's not like an imaginary thing.
Now it's going to be a Republican mayor. Sorry.
I mean, basically, I think when you put what is known about this story next to the image of Rick Jacobs' baseline, absolute minimum or highest degree of benefit of the doubt, displaying very poor professional judgment with the mayor, nominally his boss, and a number of other appointed members. So we have Heather Repenning and from the Board of Public Works. We have donors to the mayor's office. There's clearly very bad decision making going on, of the sort that it appears that the mayor was aware of. And then, of course, the other stories corroborate that it is not just bad decision-making, but behavior that is abusive and sexually harassing, and that the mayor also knew about that. This picture paired with this story, I think, is the worst possible combination for Garcetti. I think it's the ending for him.
I want to write something for the site. Hopefully by the time this episode comes out, it'll be on the website, thelapod.com, about who else is in the photo and kind of what else this photo says. But the headline for me is, like, even if you take Garcetti's word that he didn't see Rick Jacobs doing this in this photo, Rick Jacobs is not behaving like someone who is worried at all that he is going to be caught.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think the I mean, the thing about what his original, so you go back to when the allegations first came out about this type of behavior, and he said, I'm not aware of anything like this or whatever. It would have been so easy, because it's clear with how many people have come forward and now this photo, that he probably was quite aware. I mean, I would just assume that it was not an isolated incident based on so many people coming forward. It would have been very easy for him to say, yes, this was a problem, and that's why this person is not involved with me anymore. But instead, the statement was, I was not aware. And that immediately creates a big problem, because with all the other people who are likely to come forward now, especially now that this is out there, you don't really have another thing to say. Do you agree? Like, is this more damaging than just a DOT position? Is this like a mayor risk position here?
I mean, that would be the ultimate irony, right? I think Hayes said it a couple weeks ago, like he ends up not being mayor at the end of his term because he gets recalled. And that would definitely be ironic for somebody who has spent so much of his time and energy trying to get out of the city. That is hard to say at this point, I think. But I do agree.
I think a recall is a much bigger lift than the city would undertake.
Yeah, I tend to agree.
But I still see a lot of people saying it's not a big deal. I mean,
sure.
You see this on Twitter and people responding just being like, oh, well, it's not about him. You know, it's not about anything he did. So you do wonder how it will touch him. But it would have been very easy for him to say from the beginning, like, yeah, this is a bad dude. Like, I'm not associated with him, right?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, right? Because like his, like you said, his original response was, well, I wasn't aware of anything with respect to Rick Jacobs's behavior. But actually, like, even more than that, he defended him. And he said, you know, he's taking a step away from his, you know, volunteer and nonprofit work, but
like
this is
lifetime
somebody,
of public
yeah,
service.
Yeah, this is somebody who's given the past 17 years to serving our city, et cetera, et cetera. You can tell that Garcetti sees how bad this photo is for him in particular, because his quote in the Times is much, much stronger than any previously that he had given. And I think that he's correct. I think that his understanding is right. And there's, you know, there's not really a way that you can envision, even in the event that the Democrats successfully complete their long shot bid to take over the Senate, you can really imagine somebody reading Eric Garcetti's denial of his knowledge of Rick Jacobs into the congressional record saying, I did not see what is clearly taking place a few inches in front of me and to my right in this photo. And also I didn't see any of the behavior that was taking place in public related to this. It's very hard to imagine. I think Garcetti is used to a kind of treatment in the city of Los Angeles where he can distance himself from pretty much anything by just saying, I just didn't know about it. But it's hard for me to imagine that plays when this picture and this story are circulating in every newspaper in the country.
There were so many opportunities. So this happened in June of 2017. The mayor had just been reelected. Me Too, Harvey Weinstein, that was October of 2017. And it wasn't that long after that that the mayor set up his new system for reporting sexual harassment and misconduct in City Hall. That would have been the time to at least internally say, hey, we are dealing with this. This is a problem. You are A, not doing this again, and you are B, going through some kind of process to make sure that this doesn't happen again. Zero tolerance policy. Like, right. We're dealing with this with Rick Jacobs. Not only did he not do that then, he didn't do it after the lawsuit first came from the member of his security team. He didn't really acknowledge it at that point either. It wasn't until Yashar Ali came out with his story and other complaints started coming out that he actually took action on this and addressed it himself. So it's just there is no credibility in terms of addressing it now, as if you're finding out about it along with everyone else, especially as when we see these pictures, we're like, he's not hiding it. Rick Jacobs was not shy about this behavior at all. It was part of his public social identity. But this was something that could have been meaningfully addressed without even necessarily completely removing Rick Jacobs from his orbit. I think there are like processes that can take place where you inform someone that like, that you are making people extremely uncomfortable and you need to stop this behavior. Now, look at what's happening in the world. Like, look at what we're reckoning with. You are part of this and this has to end. That just so clearly didn't happen.
Did not happen. I just love in this quote. And this was a story by James Rainey in the LA Times yesterday. But I think the key thing that I look at is, he starts off his statement about this is with Mr. Jacobs's behavior. Like, I don't know this person. Mr. Jacobs, he's just somebody that I've occasionally worked with every day. Quote unquote, Tuesdays with Rick suddenly has been demoted to Mr. Jacobs.
And I just want to also note the timing of the story, which irked me. It came out on Friday. I would have at least hoped for some really important public health briefing to happen Friday night. We were promised these coronavirus updates twice a week. Once the Mayor Garcetti show went from a daily show to a twice a week show, he did not come back on Friday night, right when the story broke, to tell us about the new curfew, the risk of Thanksgiving, hospitalizations going up, like all these things. He did not appear. And it wasn't because of not wanting to face the questions from journalists about the story that broke right at that exact moment in time. So is this something that we have to look back on and be like, oh, is a reason that people maybe didn't take extra precautions this week because someone didn't come up on Friday and talk to us about what we were supposed to be doing this weekend and canceling our Thanksgiving plans? Something to think about.
Honestly, it reminds me of when Eric Garcetti like went dark before he announced that he wasn't going to run for president.
That's right.
Like, he just kind of dropped off the radar for a couple of days.
Maybe he's announcing something.
We've also heard for the first time this week chatter about another person who's potentially in the running for Secretary of Transportation, who's being significantly vetted. That is Rahm Emanuel. Did Rahm Emanuel do this? We have no evidence to suggest that. Would he? Yes, 100%.
100%.
We have an interview now with Doug Smith, Ben Oreskes from the LA Times. We're talking about bridge housing. We're talking about homelessness. That is right now on LA Podcast. We at LA Podcast would like to welcome back to the show return guests, LA Times reporters Doug Smith and Ben Oreskes. They've been doing some fascinating reporting on bridge housing in Los Angeles. Temporary housing shelters that have been built from a program initiated by the mayor's office, and also the political response and the neighborhood response to these shelters. I want to get right into it, Doug and Ben. First of all, thank you both for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having us.
It seems to me that the story that you put out this week is kind of two stories in one. There's the policy aspect where, like, about whether or not these bridge shelters have been successful at directing people into permanent housing, and also the political aspect and the pushback some of these shelters are getting. But first, let's talk about some context, the historical context behind these shelters, how they came about, who put them forward, and that history? How did this all get started?
Doug, you want to give them the history lesson? Between us, there's 55 years of LA Times experience. About 50 of it sure. is with Doug, so I think he should start.
We're not going to go back 50 years on this one, though. I think the key moment is Mayor Garcetti's State of the City speech in 2018, when he announced this program to build a shelter in every council district. And this was a somewhat dramatic shift from city policy, which at that point had been directed almost entirely toward construction of permanent housing. And the campaign for for Prop Triple H was sort of built on this idea of ending homelessness. And 2.5 years later, it was clear it wasn't ending homelessness, and some kind of change in direction was really needed. And so this was definitely a change of direction, with the city going in for a big way into bridge housing, which is essentially temporary short-term housing to get people in the first step off of the street.
Temporary in both senses, right? People are only expected to live there temporarily, and also these shelters, for the most part, were not planned to exist for longer than about 3 years. That's how it was sort of originally pitched, right?
It was sort of pitched that way in the way many things are pitched by this administration. It was just a little bit fuzzy. It wasn't really clear. The financing structure was sort of built around 3 years. The leases for the property were 3 years, but it didn't make sense did anybody believe that you were going to build 15 shelters and 3 years later the problem would be solved and they could just be taken down? Nobody really believed that.
Yeah, I certainly did. I mean, like, you're right to point that out, and also to connect it to HHH, where, you know, 2018 was a couple years after HHH was passed, and no units had been open, no permanent housing units had been opened at that point. Not that they were really expecting to, but I think you're right that homelessness had gotten so much worse in that intervening period that they needed some kind of stopgap just to get people into shelter much more quickly. So you see this as a response to just like a level of urgency that happened between 2016 and 2018.
Correct. And keep in mind, it was pre-LA Alliance lawsuit, which mm-hmm. has served to accelerate that pressure. But this was something that Garcetti did before the lawsuit was filed.
And I would just add one thing on the political end of it. You know, 2018 feels like a century ago, of course. But at that moment in time, the mayor was really talking about homelessness in a much different way than he is now. I mean, I think all politicians in LA were. We were still in this mindset of like, this could be something we could end, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the mayor actually said we were going to try to get to functional zero, which is not no unsheltered homelessness, but a very small amount of it. And he thought we could do it by 2028. I think the five of us would all agree that that ain't happening. And I think 2028 is a notable year because that's when the Olympics are coming to LA. I think it's hard to forget that, like where we were at that time. That rhetoric is a key part of this. And thinking about what the streets were going to look like, you know, well after he was leaving office was a major part of where the mayor's head was at, I think, at that time.
I think I want to touch more on that. But Doug, you brought up the LA Alliance lawsuit. And I think for our listeners, because there have been so many different lawsuits affecting different parts of this process, could you give us a little bit of background about what specifically, what pressures the LA Alliance lawsuit has thus far exerted on city government? What has changed as a result of that?
I'm going to defer to Ben on that one. He wouldn't let me cover it because he was afraid I was going to get COVID. So he's the expert on the LA Alliance.
Well, let's be clear. I think one of my biggest goals in life is to keep Doug Smith alive. I think if
and to get COVID yourself.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. So the LA Alliance lawsuit was litigation that began in March, like the week of Tom Hanks getting COVID. I was in a federal courtroom with a 77-year-old judge, I think he's 77 now, named David Carter, who sort of has been presiding or was starting to preside over a lawsuit that was brought by business owners, residents, mostly downtown, but I think there are some in other parts of the city, sort of who are alleging, you know, that the sort of state of the city with respect to homelessness was untenable, and it was kind of in violation of the Constitution. And this set off just this kind of this bomb in the city, because this judge who took the case, David O. Carter, had overseen similar litigation in Orange County. And he basically has taken on this role of kind of overseeing the city's response to homelessness in this moment that we are in, which is very unique. And that has meant that we are constantly going to court hearings that are not actually held in federal court, because the federal courthouse was closed. It's meant that the judge is calling the mayor, he's calling supervisors, calling the governor. And it's also meant that the city council has been forced to come up with a plan to house people near freeways, which has a long backstory, which we can get into if you guys want to. But this lawsuit is very important right now, because it's like where the center of the homeless response for the city and county are. And the biggest part of that is that the city and county agreed to spend, $300 million over the next 5 years to house or shelter. I'm going to use shelter because it's not exactly sure how they're going to house them. About 6,700 people who live near freeways. How we got to freeways is a big saga.
Right.
The judge is focused a lot on that. Sorry, Scott.
No, absolutely. I appreciate the background there. I think that the historical context is very important here, because exactly like you both have been saying, the way that people look at homelessness, the way that politicians respond to it, the way that voters expect politicians to respond to it, has changed so dramatically. Even over the course of the time that Mayor Garcetti has been in office, of course, he's been there for about 7 years now, almost eight. And when he took office, I think back in like 2014, as part of the sort of back to basics push, there was a smaller goal, which was we're going to end veteran homelessness specifically. That got surpassed. I mean, as the recovery from the Great Recession was proceeding and more people were falling into homelessness, I think LA Times reported that there was a 30% growth in the number of people living unsheltered on the streets from, I think, 2015 to 2018, something like that time range. We had Prop H pass. We had all of these other changes. That's when I think it's interesting. You actually see the goals growing larger as time goes on. We're going to end all homelessness. We're going to end visible homelessness and get to functional zero, as you said. Was there a sense, as you were reporting on this program, were those targets actually based on outcomes of what the city had been able to achieve? Were they purely aspirational? Was it just something that sounded good? Like you said, we haven't made much progress towards getting to quote unquote functional zero, where the number of people entering into homelessness is you know, the capacity to take people off of the streets and get them into shelter is so much greater that people do not stay unhoused for long. So I'm curious how you think about that framing as two individuals who have been reporting on this story since the program started.
Well, I think it's reasonable to say it was purely aspirational. The creation of a bridge, what is called bridge housing, is a sort of a part of a process going back a few years when the Department of Housing and Urban Development and the local continuum of care, the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, were trying to change the old model of shelter, which is you have a big room with maybe 100 cots and people come in at night and sleep, and then they leave in the day and they go somewhere else and it's cleaned up. And this was viewed, I think, correctly as not really doing anything except keeping people off the street in a warm place at night. And it led to an effort to build up services. The county, through Measure H, put more money into the shelters so that they could provide more intensive case management and housing navigation. And the idea sort of transitioned it into, instead of just being a place to give somebody shelter for the night, this would be a stepping stone into housing. And you would come into the bridge home, and you'd have all these services and support, and you'd move into housing. But the housing never really existed to move into. And there have been various methods tried. Rapid rehousing is one where you provide a rental subsidy that essentially pays most of the rent at the beginning and then kind of trickles down over 6 months to 2 years and until the tenant takes over the rent entirely. And all these things have had some level of success, but they've never actually provided enough housing out there to make the concept of bridge housing work.
And just to build on that, sorry, one other thing. I think it's important, like one of the big findings of our story was that of the nearly 1,500 people who were in these shelters through, you know, from 2018 through the beginning of this month, only about 15% of them moved into permanent housing. And about 2/3 of them went back to the street where they don't actually know where they went. And I think it wasn't just that it was aspirational, their goals. It was flawed thinking because there was never enough of any kind of housing. There's this much vaunted term throughput, which makes my eyes want to bleed when I hear it. But the idea being that you get these people into these places for 3 to 6 months and do the things that Doug was describing, and they move to the next stop. There's no next stop. It's a bridge to nowhere in some ways. I mean, that's maybe dramatic.
And we should note, too, that they did build more than 15 bridge home facilities, right?
Yeah.
I think we talked earlier, like many more than actually were expected.
It's actually a credit, you know, the political will that was mustered to get these through, which is we can talk about, was impressive. I mean, they in the sense that politicians put their necks out there, you know, held community board meetings or neighborhood council meetings, took a lot of flack for these, but said, we need these. This has to happen. And yet, I think part of why the criticism of certain members of the city council and the mayor is that people aren't seeing what their definition of success is, my street is clean. That isn't happening.
There's one kind of subtle achievement is that this program did get a shelter in almost every council district. And the shelters really used to be concentrated, of course, in Skid Row and South Los Angeles. And they weren't evenly distributed, and they didn't provide shelters to people living in the far west San Fernando Valley. And this is it's not a complete changeover, but it's sort of the beginning of changing that.
No, I was just going to add, you know, like we saw this with sort of, there was, 222 units of subsidized housing in each district. I mean, I think there was this sense that like it was an equity issue. You know, again, the brown and black parts of our city were kind of bearing the brunt of this crisis in many cases. And I think that the mayor and you know, the city council president and others sort of made it very clear that like, we're going to spread this out. We're going to make sure that everyone is pulling their weight and we're going to shame people who don't. And that was, again, to Doug's point, an achievement of some kind.
So, I mean, you talk about results and throughput. And you know,
don't
one of the goals.
Throughput again, please. I'm sorry, I even introduced that term.
Or they like, and they talk about like exiting is the other term they use. Like, what are they exiting into? You can exit into permanent housing. You can exit back onto the street. You can exit into death, as happens from these facilities. Like, what kind of results overall? Like, how does it break down the results that we're seeing from bridge housing? And I want to point out, like, with some exceptions, none of these are necessarily permanent. You can leave bridge housing, you can like get back onto the street and then end up back in bridge housing and then in permanent housing. But like, what are the numbers that we have available to us?
Doug, you want to break it down?
Best I can from memory, about 16% went into some form of permanent housing, which is sort of a combination of permanent supportive housing, which is a nonprofit, an apartment building run by a nonprofit, where you have case managers on site and help people get to the doctor or counseling. And then sort of slightly more than half of the permanent housing was either rentals that were in some cases subsidized or not subsidized, and then just moving back with family or moving in with friends. They even considered some moving in with friends as permanent housing, which is a little iffy, I would think. And then about 31% just went back to the street. They're documented as having gone back to the street. And then something like 35%, they just didn't know. They left without an exit interview, or they just couldn't classify them at all. And then smaller fractional numbers went to mental institutions or long-term nursing care or jail.
Overall, these facilities are full for the most part, right? Or are there any bridge housing that are having trouble filling these beds?
Well, full is an interesting term right now, because I mean, the thing that hangs over all of this is, you know, the pandemic that is meaning that we're not in person right now and enjoying each other's company. Mm-hmm. But also it means that these facilities are not at full capacity in what they were envisioned to be. So when the pandemic started, the Department of Public Health, you know, keenly aware, seeing huge outbreaks in San Francisco, a lot of people in New York died in shelters, Boston. One of the first big studies of like asymptomatic transmission was in a shelter in Boston, and it just showed how, mm-hmm. you know, so they were really like keenly aware of that. And we saw this with the Union Rescue Mission, which is not part of Bridge Home. I mentioned all of that to say is they got people out of these, and they kind of really shrunk half capacity some of these. Mm-hmm. And we talk about Project Room Key, hotels rented for people. A lot of the people, a significant number of people went from these shelters into hotels. So when you hear about Project Room Key, it's important to note a lot of those people weren't coming from the streets. They were actually coming from shelters that were decompressed. So many of that, they're not full in the way that they were envisioned, but there are people in lots of these. We don't have a clear picture of that, but a lot of them are not full in the way that the city had hoped they would be.
But full in the sense of all beds that are being made available right now are, like, once someone, say, like, exits back onto the street, someone from a waiting list fills that spot.
Yes.
It's not like these, because of service resistance or whatever, like, available beds are just lying
absolutely,
empty.
Absolutely. I think COVID and how quarantines have worked in these have made that much more challenging to fill those beds quickly. That's, like, anecdotal. I don't have a way to quantify that for you, but that's what I've heard talking to outreach workers, homeless people. But yeah, it's not like there's not a lot of they're not having trouble filling them because no one wants to go.
Right. So for this program, for the bridge housing program that the mayor's office has put together, I think you mentioned rightly, Ben, that people are in particular neighborhood stakeholders, homeowners, have a tendency to judge the success of the program based on whether or not they see unhoused people living on their street. Certainly that's the perception that has been given by individual city council members who have used the existence of bridge housing to say that they have made a covenant of kinds with the neighborhood groups that are in their districts, and that it is a reason to make sure that streets are swept clean in the surrounding area. I am curious, though, because that metric for the success of this program is so reliant on perceptions of people who are not making use of the service. Is there has the mayor's office or the city set any kind of goal related to these exit patterns? Is there a target for the number of people who are being placed in permanent housing? Doug mentioned that maybe that there is a generous definition being used there, but do these metrics exist? And is the city otherwise giving any sort of indication about whether or not they are pleased with the results of the numbers that you're reporting on?
Doug, you want to take this?
That's a complex question. I would make a distinction, a pretty fine distinction, but I think that as Garcetti presented this program, he put it in humanitarian terms. It was to help homeless people get into housing. And the concept of keeping the streets clean was a kind of, it was a carrot, an inducement to get acceptance of shelters in neighborhoods. And he said, we'll keep the shelters, we'll keep the area around the shelters clean. So he wasn't really making a promise that you'll see homelessness decline in your communities. It's a subtle distinction, but I think to give him credit, he presented this in a humanitarian context. And, you know, I read a filing in LA Alliance lawsuit recently in which the city was justifying the cost for another type of shelter that is going to be built. And it's turned out to be quite expensive, and there were some complaints. And the city's argument was, well, you should just divide the number by 10. It's not fair to criticize us for the entire cost. Divide the number by 10 because we're going to have these for 5 years, and two people at least will go into permanent housing each year. So each unit is worth 10 people. And it was a completely fallacious argument built on this idealized idea that these are stepping stones into permanent housing that doesn't exist. So do they have any kind of a realistic goal? No.
We have these conversations and we think about this a lot, but like without a transformation in how we build affordable housing, not subsidized housing, not AAA stuff, without more apartments for people of all kinds, these propositions don't work they just don't work.
That should be obvious, right? But that's not how these programs are presented when they're first put forward.
Yeah, and I think it's like I am guilty of this sometimes where I'm like so in the weeds with like LA Alliance and 5611 and all these different things. But it's like, you know, the proposition of this was you're in here for 3 to 6 months and then you're on to the next thing. There's no next thing. I mean, it's just in the mayor. I don't want to say to his credit, but like they recognize that they don't lead with that because it's not politically tenable. But it's like it is something they are keenly aware of and realize that the limits on their ambition, they just can't make these work without the sort of housing stock that is not coming, or I don't see it coming. I don't know.
And you have Heidi Marson, who runs LASA, saying in your article that these numbers are basically normal. Better in some ways than what you see nationally, right?
Correct.
She said. Yeah. She said that the normal rate for exiting back onto the street is something like 75% nationally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thinking being, though, with shelters is like it's a pretty transient population. I mean, in the sense that like people come and go. I think the difference they might note is that like these shelters were really meant to like have a lot more services, like intensive, like we're going to help you get your license. We're going to help you get your, you know,
it's in the name, right?
Yeah.
Like it is intended to be one step on a path out of homelessness. That I think is pretty clear as far as the intentionality from the mayor's office. I completely agree, Ben, with what you're saying about, you know, the issue of, they're just not being enough apartments for people to live in is a pretty firm roadblock in any sort of project like this. And yet I do think if you were to go back to that State of the City and other speeches that Mayor Garcetti made around the same time in early 2018, you would expect, I think, as an observer, and I think everybody in the city of LA has in the interim period become significantly more versed on issues of homeless housing and service provision sort of out of necessity. But I think you would expect going back to that there would be some sort of benchmarking, some sort of like that this is actually what we expect the outcomes for this will be. And that kind of stuff, that kind of language is absent when I go back and I look at those. And I think that that's frankly pretty surprising for a project like this.
So I think it's worthwhile to maybe just reframe the conversation a little bit. And I think it was a very difficult element of the story to, and in a sense, we didn't succeed to not cast a bridge home as a failure, because if you look back to 2015 when I first started writing about this. One of the first stories I wrote was a comparison of the number of shelter beds in Los Angeles to the number of people who are living on the street. And there was literally, there was one shelter bed for every four people living on the street. Mm-hmm. And so looking at sort of trying to measure success by how many people went into permanent housing is one way of looking at it. But another is you've got this, you have this vacuum and you're trying to fill it. And you're filling it with, do you fill it with permanent housing or do you fill it with shelter beds? Well, maybe you try the best you can to fill it with both. And the vacuum has been filled a little bit or a little bit more. And so in that sense, this is a success.
I have a cynical angle on that as well, Doug. Don't worry.
We weren't worried, Hayes. We weren't. don't worry. We weren't worried.
That ratio is very politically and legally important as well, right? The ratio of number the people who are sleeping on the street compared to the number of beds.
Yes.
Because you have federal decrees out there saying that the city cannot restrict sleeping on sidewalks or in public spaces as long as those beds don't exist. But if the city managed to get a significant number of just shelter beds up quickly, then they would have the legal justification they're seeking to increase sweeps, which is what neighborhoods are really calling for, right? Do you see any connective tissue between, like, looking at, like, it all kind of ties together, right, with, like, supportive housing is not being built quickly at all. And so shelter beds you can put up much more quickly. And if you get enough online, you can start doing sweeps again. Do you see that being a potential source of urgency, especially given how we see, we'll talk about it, how we see our elected leaders anxious to try and get these programs back in place where they can regulate whether or not people can sleep on the street?
Well, the meaning of sweeps is fairly imprecise. It means different things to different people, and they're executed in different ways at different times in different places.
Right.
But I think the real issue is coercion. It's not sweeps. And I think that it certainly is a part of that issue. And it's been the lawsuit has created a pressure point in that regard to try to get some definition as to what form of coercion is acceptable within the framework of the Boise decision.
Coercion to move your tent.
Yeah,
not, right?
The sweep is essentially saying you got to clean up and we're going to come and take whatever you don't claim, and then you can move back where you were,
or you'll be arrested if you don't move.
Well, that isn't happening, and
right,
and the city is now engaged in a conversation, and I would say they're not engaged in it very diligently at this point, but they're being forced into a conversation as to what does enforcement mean,
right?
And does it mean arrest you if you don't leave, or does it mean physically move you somewhere else, or get an order? Is it possible you could get an order that you must go to a shelter? Mm-hmm. So the lawsuit is certainly creating pressure for the city to try to resolve that.
Right. And you say that these things aren't happening under threat of arrest right now, but that's because of federal courts, right, coming in and saying
correct
that the city is not allowed to arrest people without providing the sufficient amount of shelter. But presumably they would were shelter beds to continue to increase significantly, right? I mean, like, that's how the law is being interpreted, that shelter beds count, basically.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've been in court where Carter, who let's generously say is not detail oriented, I will say, like, I don't care how you get to that number. You know, you can put tents up in a park. You know, you can count. We're writing, we're doing a lot of reporting about tiny homes, pallet shelters. I mean, there is a proverbial big tent to what can be included in this, number that we'd have to reach. And again, it's because the Boise decision, which is this Ninth Circuit ruling about that we refer to, you kind of have to have a place for someone to go before you can move them. The ruling, which was written by a kind of more liberal leaning judge, doesn't actually delineate what constitutes enough. It's a very imprecise way of saying it, but there's not a lot of law, for lack of a better way to understand this. So we're kind of making it up. And I think politicians, to the point you were making, are looking for the most expeditious way to do that.
But I think you're correct that the number of shelter beds is related to the political issue in that there's some kind of a trigger element that if you get a certain number of shelter beds, then that triggers your ability to do something else. Mm-hmm. But the real question is, what is the something else?
Yeah.
And that's undetermined right now. And that's where the focus of the conflict between property rights and other human rights and between a clean city and all those other things. It isn't, shelter beds are a trigger to let something happen, but it's what will happen that's really the important conversation.
Well, that's like the big question, I think, too, with some of the people that were interviewed in your story, the people who are living around the bridge homes, and they seem very angry that those actions haven't been taken. And I just, particularly one of the tweets that was shared as part of your story, which I know you guys don't write these or create these, but advocates were very angry that, you know, these views were platformed that were saying like, well, the bridge home is here. And like, I'm very angry. Like, I don't want this actually near me. I feel less safe. I was promised that it was supposed to be cleaner or there weren't supposed to be people living here anymore. How much of that do you think is because of the expectations that were set up from elected officials saying, oh, if we put this in your neighborhood, you won't have to deal with this quote unquote problem anymore. And they are expecting maybe an unreasonable outcome from what was presented to them originally.
You, Doug, you got it. Go run with that.
I think Venice is unique in many ways. And we tried to convey that in the story. It's very hard to convey. It's unique in the bridge home discussion also. There was tremendous opposition to this before. It's an aroused community. It's got you've got people living close together from, I mean, the really extremes of the socioeconomic spectrum all sort of pressed together. It's just a tinderbox of political emotions. The concern in going in was the San Fernando Valley and maybe in the West Side, and those conflicts have not really developed in relation to the bridge home in the San Fernando Valley at this point.
The concern was that neighborhoods would not accept shelters in those areas. You're saying, yeah,
correct. Right.
And by the West Side, you mean like Paul Kretz's district, like West LA, not the beach.
Yes.
Right. But yeah, the resistance has come in a few places, but it's interesting that you're right that most of the furor has been generated in Venice, but Mike Bonin, the representative of that district, is not one of the council members pushing for increased sweeps. You have Joe Buscaino and like closer to the South Bay. You have Councilmember Nuri Martinez and Bob Blumenfield, who are in the San Fernando Valley, and they have all sort of expressed. We had Marquise Harris-Dawson come on this show, who has also not supported the increased cleanups, and say that they made promises in citing these locations, and they have not been able to keep to those promises, partially because of the pandemic, also because of rules from federal judges. But it feels like they all sort of feel like while the mayor was maybe allowed to cast it in these humanitarian terms, they, in making these negotiations on the ground, told neighborhoods that at least these specific areas, like if you got a shelter here, the sidewalks around these shelters would not have encampments on them. And now they feel like their hands are tied from enforcing those rules, and they want to be allowed to enforce them. Is that your sense?
Because that was an important question. Ben and I went to every single one of these and looked them over, except maybe one exception. We missed the motel on La Cienega, but we went to everyone in the San Fernando Valley, and there was only one that had any substantial buildup of tents around it. and the others didn't. And there was no...
Which one was that?
That was on Etna. It's just south of the Van Nuys City Center.
What about Hollywood? Doesn't the Hollywood one have a lot of people living around it?
In the valley, they're saying.
But yeah, the three big ones with people around them on the street still, Etna, Hollywood, Venice. And Hollywood... and the ones downtown.
The first one.
Sorry, Doug.
So, you know, there has been... an issue with the Sportsman's Lodge, which was turned into a room key fairly late in the game in August. And there was a community pushback on that. But there hasn't, the shelters, now they're not all open in the valley. The Canoga Park shelter is still under construction. It should be finished by the end of the year. The Armory is like way out on the end of an alley behind some businesses, and they're just, you know, it isn't in the, most of them aren't really connected to a neighborhood in any way, and so I just don't think that's an issue in the valley.
So where is the urgency from elected officials coming from then?
Yeah, I will take that on, and I just to go back to Alyssa's question, and if I'm incorrectly paraphrasing it, stop me. But you know, you asked, like, this expectation was set by these politicians. I personally think that people were going to be mad. Like, we were promised this, and it's still there. We're mad. I think they probably would have been mad no matter what, because homelessness has grown in the city, and the streets have more people on them. So, like, we try to find a cause and effect, and maybe it's there and maybe it's not. I think that anger, and the reason I think it's important to include it in stories like this, is that it does represent a potent sort of political, something that is influencing how politicians are going to form policy over the next 18 months up until the next mayoral election, where people like Joe Buscaino, Nuri Martinez, Mike Bonin, maybe... And the list goes on, maybe running for mayor or maybe running for other offices. So I think that anger is going to just really define how a lot of policy issues are going to be kind of like debated. And to that point, like, I think you will see a lot more where in 2015 or 14, we're talking about permanent supportive housing and, you know, that stuff. We're now going to see even more talk about interim housing. We need to fix the streets now, because it goes to these bread and butter, you know, it goes to the constituent services angle of their job, which is also the vote getting angle of their job, when many of these people, almost all of them, will be running for re-election.
Yeah, I mean, it's anger and it's fear too, right? And it's mostly fear that these people are expressing of some sort of danger that they are in because of living in proximity to these encampments. The woman that you quote in your story says that she sleeps with a baseball bat and she can't take her mother for walks outside. And Ben, you and I talked about this a little. The story, to some extent, is framed in such a way that could be perceived as legitimizing that fear. It says that violent crime is up 88% in the areas around the encampments. But the fear of sleeping with a baseball bat under your pillow is that someone is going to break into your house and attack you. My experience of violent crime associated with homelessness is that it's mostly perpetrated against other people who are homeless. And I don't know if you have those numbers available, but are you aware of an instance in the Venice area where a housed person has been subjected to violent crime in their homes, outside of their homes, or like what the proportion is in these communities?
I don't have that data, and I think you bring up a very good point about how we talk about crime and particularly perceptions around crime. And I do think that in quoting her saying that, we're talking about her perceptions of crime and her fear. And you know, Doug and I's inboxes are full of people sending us videos of fires and, you know, open air drug markets and whatnot.
What's on fire, right?
Encampments. I was going to say.
Not their houses.
No,
right?
Absolutely not. But so you raise a really good point. And I think that, you know, in this story, we also quote people who are, you know, living on the street and could, you know, the toll that that is taking on their lives is one that we hope to also, you know, kind of showcase, and that like we are, that those people, like, they're the ones suffering the most. But it's a very good point, and thinking about how to kind of like dive into that data. I haven't yet. And so it's something we can do or should try to do.
I have a question related to crime data. So a lot of this, like you said, is centered around Venice, where the council member is Mike Bonin.
Yeah.
And so when you're talking about crime statistics, you get these from LAPD, who kind of give them to you in whatever form they want. The LAPD union is currently in open conflict with Mike Bonin. They've chosen him as kind of this this avatar of flip-flopping when it comes to defunding the police. They have billboards up in his district. They've sent out mailers. They sent out physical flip-flops to people who asked for them. To what extent do you not, I mean, it's like a horrible thing to have to consider from a law enforcement agency, but to what extent do you have to consider the political angle when it comes to the provision of crime statistics when you are reporting on this stuff?
Are you saying in terms of like how they are cutting up numbers in ways that would make Mike Councilman Bonin look bad?
I mean, for like in your story, it says an 88% increase in violent crime, right? And you and I talked and like got the numbers, and it's an increase from something like 40 to 75 instances of violent crime, which is it's a significant increase, but it's not like once you get into like larger and larger numbers, like that could seem to be worse than it is, especially in the context of violent crime going up around the country.
And if we're talking about those numbers, it's a very small area that we're talking about.
Right.
We're talking about like, what is it, like the six square blocks around it. I don't know the exact, but it's a very small area around it. But no, I mean, it's a good point. I mean, I think that I have to, you know, we have to be very like skeptical of that sort of data, but also, I mean, we spent a lot of time on the streets around there and talking to people, and I don't think it was like the only thing that was driving it. But how that data is presented and contextualized is significant, and you know, we can always do better. So I think it's something that's worth considering. But I do think that people who have lived there for a long time feel more threatened, and I also think that talking to homeless people on the street that I talked to said that this is a very like lame way of describing it, but they like say it has felt more chaotic, and there feels like there's less of a control on things, is what one homeless person I talked to, who's not quoted in the story, but that I think both people who are on the street and people who live in that neighborhood both said they could feel the sense of like things have the intensity of the problems there have ratcheted up. So that's,
and for people on the street, that's certainly borne out citywide with the number of deaths that we've seen, which is already, with a month to go in the year, we're past 1,100 deaths, like close to 4 deaths a day for people who are homeless. A giant increase from last year.
I'd like to just add a little bit there. I don't have any real qualms about legitimizing the perceptions of people who have tents on the sidewalk in front of their homes and see people committing crimes against each other and possibly send their children to school, and they encounter hypodermic needles on the street, or walk with their mother and they have people call at them. They're all victims. They're all victimized by the crime, and their feelings are all legitimate.
I agree with that, but it has a huge influence on policy, right? Because to the people that are housed in that area,
influence on policy.
No, but I'm saying like which perspective is prioritized, and which victimization is prioritized.
What should be prioritized is not having those conditions exist.
I totally agree with you, but to a housed person in that neighborhood, the concern is that those conditions don't exist in their immediate vicinity, which is why their preferred strategy in treating those outcomes is removal. Like we don't see the same advocacy for people to get moved into a permanent housing situation. We see them getting moved off the block. And so if you listen to the victimization claim of a house person, which is legitimate. You're totally right when it comes to kids navigate, even kids like having to walk into the street off of a like from a sidewalk that's covered in tents. That's a very real concern for parents. But the immediate solution and how money is spent is different. Like if you are listening to one of these parties over another, right? I'm not saying that like these are not like legitimate complaint, like for a parent or like someone who has an encampment nearby, but it's like the policy solutions.
Policy is certainly being driven in the city by a frustration about trash on the street and people being in the sidewalk. I do think that that is a fair statement. I don't know if Doug agrees with me, but I think that is true.
Well, I mean, the policy should be driven by the recognition that moving the problem from one place to another is going to create is going to lead to the same conclusion.
Or an increasing problem,
yeah.
Which is what we've seen for a decade.
And one thing I would say is I do think, like, I'm thinking back to Mark Ridley Thomas, City Councilman-elect Mark Ridley Thomas, and you know the mayor of Sacramento did this sort of like state commission for the governor. Mm-hmm. It resulted in a report that was pretty forgettable. But one of the things that they kind of talked a lot about was this notion of a right to shelter, and it was actually like one of it was like a kind of inflection point in some ways of mm-hmm. you know hearing people sort of talk about like it is unacceptable for it to be the way that it is now. It was like. I don't know their rhetoric, and I know Alyssa, you wrote about it a little as well, like, or I remember Curbed wrote about it a lot, very well. That like there was a change there, and I maybe am not articulating it well, and I think we are seeing that like taken to the umpteenth degree with a lot of what's happening now. So that was a lot of last year and late 2018, and I think we're just kind of seeing the continuation of that. And that right to shelter never appeared, right to housing, right to a bed. It's pretty empty rhetoric by them. Nothing changed, but the kind of rhetorical shift of politicians recognizing that there's a sort of political liability to the way that it is out there right now is real. But to Doug's point, it's like maybe some of the resulting policy changes have been myopic in that they're moving people around, but they're not thinking about the durable things that we need to do to like truly fix the problem.
What do you think will happen with Judge Carter and the rulings that are going to come down there?
Doug, you have had some more predictions on that than I have had. I'm sort of beat down from having to sit in the room and endure the long testimony of various different people. You go first, Doug, and I'll try to think of something to say.
Judge Carter is. I've attended one hearing, and I find him to be somewhat quixotic and. He's abusive and is sort of trying. He's very Trumpian, actually, in some ways. And I can see that he's had an effect. I mean, the council members in the Valley and Kern Price are hopping too. And a lot is happening as a result of Judge Carter. Where it all ends, it's, you know, who knows? He's creating a lot of tension also, and that tension could erupt in ways that are unpredictable.
I would say there's two questions there. There's the legal, purely legal one, which like doesn't seem to be anyone's concern in that courtroom. And then there's the political. In terms of the legal element, you know, as I've written in the LA Times, the man has not actually issued any orders, has not ordered anyone to do anything in a very, you know, move people, do this, do that, which he said
he was going to issue the freeway order, but then it was
vacated. It was vacated. And that's a significant thing because it means that a lot of what is happening on the street lacks this like legal cover. So the freeway order
being, just to recount for people who don't know, that you would have to be relocated from if you lived near a freeway or under a freeway, you have to be relocated by a certain time.
Within 500 feet. The significance of that is that what Carter has done, though, he has given politicians like Bob Blumenfeld, like Kern Price, a political cover to go out and do things that they probably wanted to do before. And they can say, the judge is telling me to do this, even though he's not really in the formal legal sense, but he may be saying it. So there's a lot of that going on, and there's a lot of wheel spinning, and there's a lot of chaos.
But electeds in both sides of the homelessness aisle are using Judge Carter's opinions, right? You hear
exactly.
Mike Bonin saying that Judge Carter, if you try and move people out of the area around shelters, Judge Carter will slap it down, which he has essentially said that he will do.
Yes, and Carter is, you know, I've spent a lot of time with him. I've interviewed a lot of people who've known him through the years. I think he's framed as this sort of like anti-homeless person a lot of the time. He's really not. I mean, he really does care about people who are out there. And he wants to go out, which is a lot more than most judges. Like, I mean, I have walked Skid Row with him multiple times. I mean, he's out there. I think his views of it are like not in line with like research and the sort of mainstream views of on homelessness, which has like that is where some of those pressure points that Doug is referring to. So, I mean, he's threatened to hold the city and specific members of the city council in contempt if they don't meet the number of shelter beds, or beds, again, not shelter beds. They can be a lot of different kinds of beds. By April next year, he's threatened to hold them in contempt. What does that mean? I don't know. Like, do they care? I don't know. So, but at the same time, like, no one, he claims that we shouldn't have been surprised that he issued this freeway order. They were surprised, they being politicians. He could do a lot of things. You know, there is conversations about what they've referred to as a global settlement, which would sort of create, to adhere to the Boise ruling that we discussed before, this kind of ratio of how many shelter beds would we need to satisfy like moving people off the streets, the coercion aspect that Doug was talking about. Those conversations don't appear to be moving. And so I think we're in for a lot of wheel spinning and maybe not a lot of progress. But, I mean, he unlocked money that wasn't being spent before. That's something. That's notable.
What I see is that he's zeroed in on the freeways in particular and the city more generally in a numbers game. And he's put pressure on the county to contribute more money. But he hasn't brought in the mental health system and the health system, the jail system, which are all a part of this. And he without all of that, I mean, if he had the capacity to frame all of that as one coherent drive, I would feel much more optimistic.
And so this week, related to this, the city council had scheduled to take a vote on the expansion of Municipal Code 4118, which would have allowed for encampments to be removed out of areas around freeways, around bridge housing, in other public spaces. Nuri Martinez announced last week that that vote was not going to happen.
A Friday news dump, if you will.
Yep. After a lot of pushback from advocacy groups like K-Town for All the Services and That Sweeps Coalition, instead they are going to have a global conversation about homelessness and what they're going to do about it. What do you see as coming next out of the city council? Is 4118 dead? Are they leaving it until new council members are seated in December? Are they leaving it until after the new vote for council president happens on December 15th? Like, what should we expect here?
Doug is smiling because he has next week off and doesn't have to listen to the city council meeting, which I will be listening to. The short answer is it's not clear. The where I see this going is let's like rewind to 2 or 3 weeks ago when this first was rushed before the city council. You know, it was like kind of dropped on a Friday. They were going to vote on it the next week. People freaked out. And also not just sort of the Services Not Sweeps ilk who are kind of constitutionally opposed to how these things are framed. I think a lot of people who were more sympathetic to this law, to kind of these changes in the ordinance, were like, did we really think this through? It felt half-baked to many people, and they wanted things to change. This is all also a kind of a run back of a fight we had last year about similar ordinances.
Which at the time was brought by Councilmember Mitch O'Farrell, who is now opposed to this same rule being expanded.
It's sort of dizzying, yes. I think so. I think I just, at that debate last, a couple weeks ago, you know, Bob Blumenfeld, who's kind of been at the center of a lot of this, because in his district, him and Carter got together to kind of begin this, they're going to clean or move and clean underpasses in his district. So focusing on the freeways. And Blumenfeld made a point during that hearing about how successful that had been. They moved 70 people or something like that over a two-week period. We don't have to get into all of that. But what he said was, is people are going to come back if I don't have a way to keep these areas clear. And so I think for many of these council members, that is a very, like, real thing. And not just real in the sense of, like, they're going to make all this it's like sort of like whack-a-mole or like Sisyphean in that way. It's that, like, they recognize that for them to have this effect of keeping the streets clean and also kind of satisfying some of the stuff that Carter wants them to do, they're going to need something on the books that says, you can't be here. You can't not be here. And it's been pretty clear that the city attorney thinks that what is currently on the books is either unconstitutional or would lose in court. So I think they're going to have to deal with this at some point. When is unclear to me. Doug and I were actually talking about this recently. And I don't know if it's they're waiting for new council members. I think what's notable as well, and sorry if I'm rambling, I often do, is that, you know, a lot of this would have occurred behind closed doors under former council president Herb Wesson. You know, that was a city council that there were a lot of 15-0 votes, 14-1. Dissent was very coordinated or choreographed. What's kind of fun about this, or fun as a person who's observing it, is we're watching them kind of like think through these things in real time. So I think, why Mitch kind of flip-flop? I don't have a good answer on that, but we're watching
I
them.
I do.
Well, and I'm sure you have many thoughts on that. And you can use your podcast
talk about
to tell
it all
us
the
them.
Time.
Yeah, exactly. but what I'm trying to say is, I think for many of these people, these elected officials, they like this venue to talk to their constituencies in different ways. Did I miss anything, Doug?
I think what I think is that the judge and the council are playing footsies with each other. back in September, with the one hearing I attended, Councilman Price and Councilman Blumenfeld asked the judge, I won't say pleaded, but it was like close to pleading, to give them some guidance. They did not use the word enforcement, but it was really clear what they were asking was, tell us what tools to enforcement tools you are going to give us. And the judge didn't answer. He didn't give them those tools. It's like, you guys figure it out for yourself.
Yeah.
And this was an attempt to figure it out, and they couldn't. So it's whose move is it now?
Mm-hmm. And the judge has been very leery of issuing orders, because the one that we talked about with the freeways, which was vacated, like, from my own reporting, I can tell you how close the city and county came to appealing that to the Ninth Circuit. And that would have just been this, like, that would have been more litigation, longer. And I think that hangs over a lot of this, where we've heard Bonin, who's, you know, usually kind of zagging when others are zigging, or whatever, however you say that. I mean, he has said, just issue an order. Tell us what to do, judge. A lot of people want that clarity, because they can't seem to offer it to the public themselves.
We could go much longer. We're out of time.
This is a good way to spend a Saturday night.
Right?
This is like so much fun. We've probably really stuck our foot in our mouth here.
Yeah, I mean, it's bad. I mean, but Doug put a tie on at least to do it. I'm in my Northwestern. Northwestern one. I had to wear my sweatshirt. You know, I.
You guys are great. You play such a significant role in covering the most important issue that the city is facing right now and offering clarity that we don't often get from the city. And we really appreciate it. We appreciate you being here, and we appreciate everyone listening to the show. We'll be back next week on LA Podcast. Bye.